So it's a pleasure to be here, and I'm glad there's so many people still willing to sit around and hear talks on a Friday afternoon. I'm in trying to prepare this review. I ran into a bunch of obstacles because there's so much material out there and so little time to present it. And so the first thing I decided to do, since this is the Institute of Theoretical Physics, I would leave the theory to the theorists and leave the theory out. So I'll try and keep the theory to a minimum and just cover the experimental end of things. The next talk will cover some of the theory. I'm also going to leave out a lot of other interesting things that are going on in magnetic tunneling and just stick to tunneling in molecular magnets. So I should acknowledge my collaborators, Miriam Saracek and Yi-Cheng Zhang at City College of New York, where resonant tunneling of magnetization was discovered. Javier Tejada and his group at University of Barcelona. Ron Ziolo and a student of his made some of the original samples for us. They're chemists. Dave Hendrickson and Sheila Aubin at UCSD have made samples for us more recently. Our chairman here is a very important part of our collaboration, the theorist in it. These people are neutron scatterers who we've done some work with. Steve Hill, I'm just starting up a collaboration with. He's at Montana. We're doing some electron spin resonance experiments. So my goal in this talk is to give you an idea of sort of some of the history of molecular magnets and tunneling in them, and to try and convince you that tunneling in molecular magnets is more interesting than tunneling in just about anything else. And some of the key features are that molecular magnets can be characterized to a great degree of precision, and so we can compare our experimental results with theory, and that's really what makes these the seminal systems to study. One of the most interesting things that we found about them is that they seem to show quantum effects above what is canonically known as the thermal quantum crossover temperature, where you're only supposed to see thermal effects. You can see selection rule violation and thereby determine what causes tunneling. And the last thing I'll talk about is some work recently done in Grenoble that shows quantum, what's called quantum phase interference. And the next speaker, I think, will talk about that in some detail as well. So usually when I give this talk, somewhere in the middle of it, I start to talk about what causes tunneling. And invariably, there's someone in the audience who looks very perplexed at that point, because they've been studying one tunneling system or another, whether it be hopping or tunneling in nuclear matter, and they never asked themselves that question, or if they did, they thought it was a trivial question. And it is a trivial question in almost all cases, but spins, as I said, are more interesting. And the reason it's a trivial question in most other systems, which I'll call particles, although they don't have to be particles at all, it could be a flux state in the squid, for example, is the Hamiltonian is written quite simply as a particle type Hamiltonian. And the reason there's tunneling is because, well, position and momentum don't commute, and that's pretty much the end of the story. Well, for spins, we don't have this kinetic degree of freedom, and the Hamiltonian looks something like this. You have some anisotropy term, which creates a barrier for you to tunnel through, and you have a Zeeman term from your magnetic field, and if your magnetic field is in the right direction, SZ is a conserved quantity, and there is no tunneling. So you need some other term, called H prime, to break the symmetry and produce tunneling, and so you can learn a lot about what causes tunneling based on the symmetry of of that Hamiltonian H prime and the symmetry of the data that you get. So tunneling is an ubiquitous event in physics. We have a double well potential. It could be any sort of double well potential. You put a particle over here, and then you wait some time, and you measure it later, and you find that it's over here. And there are two ways it could have gotten there. It could have been thermally kicked over the barrier, or it could have tunneled through it. And both of these have some exponential dependence on the barrier height. The thermal process is just a Boltzmann factor, but in the tunneling process, the temperature in the Boltzmann factor is replaced by some T star, some constant, which is known as the crossover temperature, the quantum classical crossover temperature. And it's pretty much been up until we started studying molecular magnets, it was pretty much understood that above T star, you couldn't see quantum effects. You just see this, the thermal process would dominate, and that's about it. But what's interesting about the molecular magnets, one of the things that's interesting, is that we don't have this either-or situation. We can see tunneling above the crossover temperature. We have some hybrid where you're thermally activated somewhat to the top of the barrier, and you tunnel across up there. And I'll get to that later in the talk. So why did people get interested in molecular magnets? Well, there are fundamental reasons. The chemists who really started working on them, most of them being in Florence, Italy, they started looking at them because they wanted to understand how you get from paramagnetism on the atomic scale up to bulk ferromagnetism on the macroscopic scale. So they started building little bigger and bigger magnets and wanted to see when that crossover occurred. Well, as you start doing that, you also start crossing over from quantum behavior to classical, and this is the area that I'll be talking about. There are a lot of other reasons people are interested in them. They represent the ultimate in magnetic storage density. Unfortunately, nobody knows how to address a molecular magnet quite as small as these are. At the same time, they've been put forth as candidates for elements in quantum computers. But again, you need to be able to address them somehow, which is still a difficulty. People have talked about making lasers out of these because the energy levels are in a regime that there aren't too many lasers available. I think the most important reason to study molecular magnets is because they're good things to study. They can be characterized with a great deal of precision, and so we can really compare what we've got with what we've got and what we expect. The other thing that's nice about them is you have a large ensemble. In a typical crystal, there are around 10 to the 17 nominally identical molecules. Not all of them are exactly identical. And that makes it easy to know what you're looking at rather than most ensembles of magnetic particles, which, well, some of them are a little bigger, some of them are a little smaller, some of them are pointing this way or that way. In these, they're all pretty much pointing the same direction. They all look the same. They're all doing just about the same thing. So let me introduce you to a couple of these. The first one is known as manganese 12. Chris Landy gave a nice talk yesterday in which he noted that most physicists hate to look at chemical formulas. This one's a rather friendly one. There are 12 manganese ions, 12 oxygens. This is just an acetate ion, so some vinegar here and some water. The spin configuration, actually, there's some neutron data that shows that this is more than the cartoon, and it seems to be right. When you do the arithmetic, with the spin 3 halves and spin 2 ions, you get spin of 10, which is what's measured. Well, I should say, I mean, this is just one molecule, but well, this is the center of the molecule. What's not shown here is that these important acetates. And these acetates hang off the sides here, and they separate all the molecules from the other molecules in the crystal. And so the interaction between them is minimal. The Curie-Weiss temperature is around 50 millikelvin, and we do experiments at 2 or 3 Kelvin. So we have a set of identical molecules in the crystal that basically do not interact. They're just individual spin 10 objects. So here's another molecular magnet called iron 8. I won't show you its formula because it is a little more nauseating. And the difference between this one and the previous one is you'll notice it's a little less symmetric. This has two-fold symmetry. The manganese 12 had a four-fold symmetry. It has the same spin, S equals 10. The molecules are a little closer together, so the dipole interactions are stronger. And I'll be talking about some of the interesting things that come out of this molecule because of the fact that it's less symmetric later in the talk. Well, they're in a crystal, so they're neutral. So it's a van der Waals crystal.
You can see the spin 10 as a little magnet.
Right.
It's not a quantum magnet.
Well, that's debatable. So physicists started to get interested in molecular magnets, I think, when this paper was published. The Florentine group showed that at low enough temperatures, I didn't mark the temperatures, I think this is 2 Kelvin, this is 2.8 Kelvin, at low enough temperatures, this system became hysteretic. And so you have, this is the first molecule that seems to act like a magnet, a real magnet, a real bulk magnet. And if you look at this closely, you see there's a funny little dip here, and there's a funny little dip on the other side here, and it's a strange fate of history that their magnet had such a long settling time that they could only measure these few points in any reasonable amount of time, and so they missed something that was kind of important. And then a couple years later, they were looking at the relaxation time of this system as a function of magnetic field, and one of the things that was kind of striking is you expect that as you increase field, the relaxation time should just decrease monotonically. But instead, there seems to be this sharp dip around zero field, and they found another one here, which is sort of at the wrong place. But that's not important. The important thing is this led them to make a rather radical conjecture that there was some sort of resonant tunneling effect going on in these molecules, and it turns out that they were absolutely right, and that there is resonant tunneling, and that's what I will try to convince you of. So some of the samples that we measured at City College were actually powdered samples, so just a bunch of very small crystals, and we wanted to have a sample that looked in some way like a single crystal. So what we did is we mixed the powder with an epoxy at all at room temperature. We mixed it with an epoxy, and then we put on a huge magnetic field, the largest one we could produce. And the crystallites have this large shape anisotropy. They're needle-like. And so the field basically just torqued them to line up with the field, and so we have all these little crystallites all pointing in the same direction. So we have a sample with all the molecules are all pointing pretty much in the same direction to within a few degrees. And then when we looked at the hysteresis loops, we found these rather unusual steps in the history of Islam. And you can see that the steps are there as you raise the field. There's a step, another, and then you reach saturation. And then on your way down, as you reduce the field, nothing interesting happens until you cross zero field again. And you're increasing the field in the other direction and you see steps again.
How does it depend on the field sleep grade?
Does what depend? As you
the shape of the
shape of the steps doesn't depend on the field sweeping rate. What happens is as you increase the field sweeping rate, the loop gets larger. It's as if you were lowering the temperature. So it scales that way. Basically, what's happening is you're. As you sweep it faster, it doesn't have as much time to relax, and so the loop is broader as you expect, and you get to see the same kind of.
The steps remain the same position.
The steps are all in the same position and field. I'll show you that next. And what you can see also is as you lower the temperature, you see that a step that was clear at a high temperature, as you lower the temperature, it seems to sort of fade away and disappear. But it hasn't really disappeared. If you actually slow down the sweep rate, the step will come back. And so the step is slowed down, but it hasn't disappeared as you lower the temperature. So you can take, if you work harder, you can line up these crystals better. So this is basically the same sort of data. The steps are a little clearer here. Take the derivative of this. You see that all the steps, independent of temperature, occur at about the same magnetic field. And it's also independent of sweep rate. It's independent of just about any experimental parameter. And it looks like there's actually some systematic dependence here on temperature. And that's actually an interesting kind of artifact. It actually doesn't depend on temperature. It depends on magnetization. Because the field the molecule sees is not just the external field, it's the field, the mean field from all the other molecules around. And if you take that into account, then you can bring all these right on top of each other to within experimental error. So there really seems to be particular values of field where these steps occur. So if I label these steps, I'll call this one 0, this one 1, 2, 3, and plot those that step number as a function of the field at which they occur, falls on a straight line, which means that the steps occur at regular intervals of field every 0.46 Tesla. So this is zero field cooled data. The sample is cooled in zero field, and then a field was applied to measure it. And so what's happened is you've frozen the system with about half of the, you've cooled it in zero field, so you've frozen it with about half of the spins up and half of them down. Then you apply a field and raise the temperature. And so as you raise the temperature, spins start to flip to line up with the field, and eventually you reach a point where they've all reached equilibrium, and then the rest is Curie law, pretty much. And the peak here in these curves is known as the blocking temperature. And notice that at 0.9 Tesla, something really strange is going on. This curve has suddenly jumped towards the left. And once you get to a slightly higher field, it's jumped back. And so if you take this peak here, the temperature at which that peak occurs, that blocking temperature, and plot it as a function of field, you see that it has these dips in it. And these dips occur at the same fields at which the steps occur in the hysteresis loop. And generally, the blocking temperature is thought to be a measure of the barrier height. And so it seems like somehow the activation barrier for spin reversal has decreased. And you can then do direct relaxation measurements. Again, in this case, the sample is cooled in zero field. And then we put on a field of 0.9 Tesla or 0.95 Tesla. 0.9 is pretty close to one of those magic fields. And you notice that at the lower field, the relaxation rate is much faster, which is counterintuitive. You expect the higher the field is, the lower the barrier is, and the faster the relaxation, but instead the opposite occurred. Now, if you have a system of identical molecules or identical anything relaxing, you expect it to obey an exponential relaxation law in time, and that expectation is clearly not obeyed here. And this is a log scale versus time, so it should be a straight line. But since we didn't have a clear idea of why that was, it seems that it has something to do with impurities in the system. We decided just to fit the long time tail to an exponential to get something quantitative out of it, and that seems to work pretty well. So when you do that, you get the relaxation rate as a function of field. And I guess I'm beating a dead horse here, right? At these special fields, the relaxation rate is faster, and this explains why there are steps in the hysteresis loop and why there are the dips in the blocking temperature. Everything has to do with the fact that the relaxation somehow increases dramatically when you reach these particular fields. And so the way we explain this is a model of thermally assisted resonant tunneling between spin states, which was first suggested, as I said, by Novak and Cecily way back when they just saw those two anomalous dips in their relaxation measurements. So we can model this as a double well potential. This well, we say, is spin up, and this one is spin down. And this anisotropy barrier here is due to the magnetocrystalline anisotropy. Wants the point either up or down in the crystal along the c-axis. And the tilt here, the asymmetry, is caused by the magnetic field, making it want a point down more than up. And at particular values of magnetic field, these levels, which are just the different projections of the spin along the z-axis, these levels in the left well will come into resonance with levels in the right well, and then we'll get resonant tunneling. And so what we think is happening is that we're being thermally kicked up to some high-lying level near the top of the barrier. And then when we reach this level, the tunneling rate is so fast that we instantly go across and decay down to the other side. And if we're off of resonance, then we basically have to go all the way over the top of the barrier. And so what this resonant tunneling process does is it sort of cuts off the top of the barrier, reduces the effective barrier height, and thereby gives these steps in the hysteresis loop and all the associated phenomena. So we can be more quantitative about this. Write down a Hamiltonian for it, for this system. This is our anisotropy energy, making it want a point along the z-axis or anti-parallel to it. Zeeman term, and this extra term, which let's neglect for the time being, but seems to have come out of recent experiments. If we neglect this term, it takes about three lines of algebra to find the field at which levels will come into resonance, levels on opposite sides of the barrier come into resonance, and you find it to be just an integer multiple of this anisotropy parameter over the g value. And that's nice because it says that there'll be these level crossings at regular intervals of magnetic field, which is what we observe. And since we know experimentally that there are these steps every 0.46 Tesla, we can infer that D over G is 0.31 Kelvin. Now, when we first made this discovery back in 95, we didn't have very good data to compare D and G to, so it looked okay in terms of the data that was available when we waved our hands about the whatever disagreements there were. And then some good ESR experiments were done, and lo and behold, they disagreed radically. And One of them predicted D over G to be 0.29 and another one to be 0.33, and we're right in the middle. So that's not so terrible, but not so great, especially if you look at these parameters here, which differ quite substantially. So we went and let me make a tangential side. We went and did some neutron scattering so we could measure this. And neutron scattering is nice. You can do it in zero field. And then you don't need to worry about G as an extra fitting parameter. You can determine the anisotropy all by itself. So we took this inelastic neutron scattering spectrum, and you have to take my word for it, but wherever there are arrows here, there are peaks in the spectrum. I picked this plot to show because it shows all of the peaks, but none of them very well. But if you look at other detectors, you can see some of the peaks much better. So we really know where these peaks are much better than this transparency seems to show. And then if you plot the energies of those peaks as a function of the level that we think it belongs to, the data fall here. And the results from the two different ESR experiments, well, one of them clearly doesn't fit our data, and the other one fits it to within error bars of our fit. So it seems that we've determined really what the anisotropy parameters are. So another test. Well, I'm running low on time, so I'll skip that, and I'll come to my question of what produces tunneling. So I expect no puzzled looks at this point. The usual way of treating this, treating tunneling in spin systems, is to say, well, there's going to be some transverse magnetocrystalline anisotropy of a form SX squared, which you can write in terms of spin raising and lowering operators. Notice that they're to the second power, which implies a selection rule that M has to change by multiples of 2. And this says that every other level crossing will be forbidden. We won't be able to get tunneling. And yet we see all the level crossings. None of them are missing. So that's a problem. And in the case, it's actually worse for manganese 12, which has tetragonal symmetry. And so you have fourth powers, and delta M has to be a power of a multiple of 4. So because we seem to see all the steps and they all look about the same, we're forced to conclude that the tunneling is at least in large part produced by a transverse magnetic field, which you can write simply as a linear power of the transverse spin operator. So all the transitions are allowed, and I alluded to before the fact that we think that the tunneling is occurring from high lying levels, not near the bottom of the barrier. And if you take this expression from Guranin for the tunneling rate depending on the level, the spin, and the transverse field, and put in around, say, 100 gauss of transverse field, which is typical of hyperfine type fields for manganese, you find that the tunneling rate is pretty high the first three levels, reasonably high. But when you get to the bottom of the barrier, it's longer than the lifetime of the universe, so tunneling really does have to be occurring near the top of the barrier. Well, if there's this hyperfine or dipole field, we think it's hyperfine because dipole fields seem to be unimportant here from some other experiments. If there are these hyperfine fields, these transverse random hyperfine fields that are producing the tunneling, well, they should be randomly interspersed, different for each molecule, moving around, and so we should get inhomogeneous broadening of the resonance. And I want to show you that we actually don't, and we don't really understand why. So the argument I just went through is, well, we have resonant tunneling, no selection rule, so we conclude there's a transverse field, and we know the hyperfine fields are a few hundred gauss, and so they should be there. But here's one of those resonances mapped out in great detail. Measured the relaxation rate. It's a function of the applied field. This is the zero field resonance. And you see, if you fit this, it fits very well to a Lorentzian. And a Gaussian fit just doesn't work, especially in these tails here. These long Lorentzian-like tails. And so the hyperfine fields just seem to be missing somehow. And we did this at several different temperatures, and you get the same results. And also, if you believe that this line width here represents some lifetime of the level that's doing the tunneling, and you assume, say, it's m equals 3, it doesn't really matter, you find that it's huge. It corresponds to a line width of 10 to the 10 hertz, which is a lot larger than anything else we know to be going on in the system. So I said I wasn't going to talk about theory, but I'll mention it briefly. One of the earliest attempts to treat the resonant tunneling in these systems was done by Goranin and Chudnovsky. And one of the things they did is when they calculated the resonances, they found that they were much too sharp to correspond to the actual data. And they made the reasonable assumption, well, there are hyperfine fields around, and that should broaden the resonance, and that will broaden it to about the size that's seen. But of course, that broadening is Gaussian. And a lot of other people have done the same thing, and I won't mention everybody who's been calculating the resonant tunneling in the system. But nevertheless, almost all of them have needed to fall back on the idea that the resonances are too narrow, and they should inhomogeneously broaden them. But we don't see any inhomogeneous broadening. So we're left with the line shape mystery. And we really don't know what the meaning of this line width is. It's just much too large. It's larger than the Arrhenius prefactor by 3 orders of magnitude. It's 2 orders of magnitude smaller than the Larmor precession frequency. And it can't be the tunneling rate for a variety of reasons, especially the fact that we can't seem to change it. So after we raised that question in the literature, Leuenberger and Loss did a complete density matrix calculation and claimed to have resolved this problem. Their calculation is nice in the fact that it uses only experimental parameters that are known. They had one fitting parameter, and that seems to now no longer be a fitting parameter. So, you know, the shape is Lorentzian. It's about, or it looks like it's Lorentzian. It has long tails, and it's about the right width. So it seems to be a step in the right direction. And they explain the problem with the anomalous width by saying that really the Lorentzian is much sharper than we're measuring, and it's been cut off at the top not by inhomogeneous broadening, but by the fact that the tunneling rate, that the thermal activation process is no longer the bottleneck, that the tunneling rate becomes the bottleneck at this point. And that at first blush seems like a reasonable explanation, but then if you look at our data and their fit again, you notice that, I mean, it really doesn't work very well in the tails here. And the problem is, see, our data really does fit a Lorentzian, and this their fit is kind of like a Lorentzian, but it's a cutoff Lorentzian that's really heading this way. And so it really doesn't work. And we really still don't know what the measured resonant line width means. Okay, so in the time I have left, I want to talk about work I haven't been involved with. First, I'd like to point out that hyperfine fields really must be driving the tunneling here. This is a different molecule that I'll only mention briefly, called manganese 4. And the important thing about manganese 4 is that it's a half integer spin. And Yes, it still shows these telltale steps in the hysteresis loop right around at zero field. And Kramer's theorem says, well, you can't have tunneling at zero field. And so this looks like a Kramer's theorem violation. And since I'm not a high energy physicist, I won't claim that we've broken time reversal symmetry spontaneously. There has to be some sort of internal field that's driving the tunneling, and the best candidate is the hyperfine fields, and yet, I'll reiterate the point, we can't seem to find evidence that they're really there. They must be, but they must be doing something more complicated than just being some random background field that would produce inhomogeneous broadening. Okay, so let me turn now to talking about iron 8, where there's some interesting stuff that's been going on. Here are some hysteresis loops of iron 8, and they show these steps just like in manganese 12, and they're regularly spaced, and everything else looks about the same. One of the first things that was important about this molecule is that at low temperatures, all the hysteresis loops start to fall on top of each other, which indicates that it's ground state tunneling. And so that was sort of the original breakthrough with iron 8, that the tunneling is no longer thermally assisted. It's no longer getting kicked near the top of the barrier and tunneling through. It's tunneling from the ground state directly. Another interesting experiment was the observation of coherence in this system. And there's a poster at the back about this, so I won't go into much detail. A large transverse magnetic field was used to suppress the barrier so that the tunnel splitting of the ground states was large enough to measure. And then photons essentially were put on electron spin resonance was done to look for this ground state splitting. And so the AC susceptibility had a couple of peaks in it, and these peaks could be interpreted as these tunnel splitting depending on which way the molecule was oriented. And the nice thing, again, about these systems is you can, because they're so well characterized, there are no fitting parameters here. These lines here are exactly where the peak should occur, and that's where they're found to occur. So this seems to be very convincing evidence that there's coherent tunneling in this system. The last thing I want to talk about, some recent work done by Wolfgang Wernsdorfer and Roberta Cecily, where they saw a very exciting effect, which I call topological tunnel blocking, and they call quantum phase interference, and Stuart Barnes will call something completely different. So I'll give you my rinky-dink type of analysis of what this is. 2 minutes? Okay. Consider a spin that where its two ground states are to the left and to the right. And iron 8 obeys this Hamiltonian. It has a biaxial anisotropy. And so there's this symmetry around the x-axis, 180-degree rotational symmetry around the x-axis. And so it can tunnel one of two ways. It can tunnel passing through the y-axis or rotating around and passing through the minus y-axis. And those two tunneling paths can cause interference. And if that tunneling spin is an integer, that interference will be constructive, and if it's a half integer, it'll be destructive. And so this is Kramer's theorem, and this kind of explanation was given by these authors quite a few years ago now. This topological tunnel blocking, as I call it, I see as a generalization of Kramer's theorem that Garg noticed in 95. If you put on a transverse magnetic field along the x-axis, this twofold rotational symmetry around the x-axis is still preserved, but the spin states are no longer along the z and minus z axis. They're pulled up a little towards the magnetic field, And so the solid angle that's encompassed inside this inside the circle here is smaller, and at particular values of the magnetic field, you'll get destructive interference, and tunneling will be completely suppressed. And this was the effect that was seen by Bernstorffer and Sessely very recently. So this is the theoretical calculation of these values of magnetic field. If the field is precisely aligned along the x-axis, the tunneling rate is completely suppressed. And this is what they found experimentally. And the agreement is, in my opinion, very convincing. And the other thing that's interesting in regards to this is the parity effect that they found, which is, if you notice, that the m equals one step, the one where that should be forbidden, the at zero field, its tunneling rate is lower, whereas the n equals zero step is higher, and they oscillate out of phase with each other. And so it seems that the parity is there. It's a little weaker than one might expect. It seems to be there. And I'm desperately running out of time, it seems. So let me just put up my conclusions, which is what I started with, and say that I hope I've convinced you that molecular magnets are more interesting tunneling systems than most tunneling systems, by and large because they show thermally assisted resonant tunneling, which occurs above the crossover temperature. They show the selection rule violation, which indicates that there is a magnetic field that's driving the tunneling, and they show this exciting new effect of quantum phase interference, or what I call topological tunnel blocking, and what Stuart Barnes will call something else. Thank you.
If you just take your line shape and fill it with void, what would be the ratio of Gaussian component and Lorentzian component?
I can't find a Gaussian component.
Not at all. So just
it's got to be less than 50 Gaussian width, but I can't find it.
This might be like finite line width for your states in the.
That's the way I'd interpret it, except the numbers are nonsensical. 10 to the 10 hertz is just a ridiculous.
So there is some other mechanism for those.
Yeah. But I haven't heard it.
Yeah, you showed a calculation by Skarajian and Chudnovsky of tunneling rates, for example.
Yeah.
But you never showed any quantitative data about rates, and I wondered if there's any, I didn't notice it anyhow, if there's any comparison.
Is there a comparison? Did you make a comparison? I don't have the paper with me.
All this theoretical work of recent years make quantitative comparison with the rates to the order of magnitude. Of course, the locations of maxima are easy to obtain, but the rate itself, the number, is much more difficult to obtain because it depends on mechanisms of relaxation, spin form, or whatever is involved. But you can get the order of magnitude.
Yeah. There's data on that.
Well, there's plenty of clear-cut data. I think the state of the art in terms of theory and experiment is this Leuenberger and Loss calculation, simply because it takes into account every measured value for the anisotropy parameters, the G values, the speed of sound, and there's nothing. There's nothing open to interpretation. There's very little hand waving allowed.
Would the supramagnetic resonance not give you some information about the relaxation mechanism?
Well, I don't know if it'll. Here's a transparency I skipped. Yeah, one of the things I have a friend at University of Arkansas is trying to do some NMR on these things and. Try to see, well, first of all, where are the hyperfine fields? What are they doing? And I've heard rumors that there are people in Tallahassee who have already taken some data, but I haven't seen it. I don't know anything about it.
Thank you.
How many such sea well systems that you show is often usefully discussed in terms of the actual eigenstates, and what do these phenomena sound like when they're expressed in terms of eigenstates?
What would they sound like?
Eigenstates and splitting of eigenstates. You know what I'm speaking about.
I can give you this simple hand waving.
What is this, this complicated topological something or Cramer's theory? What does that? What is that in terms of the eigenstate?
The simplest hand waving I can do is that, I mean, these different eigenstates are just simply different m values of the spin, the magnetic quantum number, and the tunneling would be represented simply by superpositions. I'm not sure what more you're looking for.
Particularly your last discussion, which I couldn't quite follow, about these Cramer's phenomena. What are they in terms of the eigenstates?
Well, Cramer's theorem, you know, any half-integer spin can't tunnel. So these m and minus m are strictly degenerate, and so you could write this as the eigenstates, or this is the eigenstates, or any superposition is the eigenstates. The symmetry is not broken; it's time reversal symmetry.
I can give the answer to this question, probably the answer which you want to think. If I simply diagonalize the Hamiltonian of spin 10, then see that some readings disappear at particular values of the field, of the magnetic field. And you can interpret it in terms of fancy topological model, but of course you can see it just from diagonalizing.
Okay, thank you.
No sweating, no tunnel.
Right.
Line shape question. Of course, when you see one asking line shape, please, people who are using magnetic resonance, the first thing that occurs to you is something like emotional. Generally, if you get a Gaussian line shape, of course, with statics, say hyperfine field, or about the time that
I'm not prepared to deal with that kind of question. I know that there are people working on it. There are people working on the theory of it. But, I mean, if you take just a simple model that these hyperfine fields are randomly are random static fields, then, right. Right, the nuclear moments are fluctuating. But they're presumably fluctuating much faster than the tunneling dynamics, and they're certainly fluctuating much faster than the thermal time it takes to get activated to do this tunneling. So I would, you know, you could argue that they completely average out. It's possible.
Typical produced Lorentzian line.
Right, but then what is the Lorentzian line?
Are there any other questions?